From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made at UCLA in 1981. Dr. Michael Gottlieb was looking for a case to use for teaching purposes related to immunology, and he asked one of the trainees to go to the hospital and ask for a patient with immunologic features. Remarkably, that trainee came back with the story of a patient who appeared to have something unusual, something perhaps undiagnosed so far. The patient was a 31-year-old gay white man who had lost about 30 pounds. He had skin infections, had developed a kind of pneumonia called pneumocystis. But here's the thing. That kind of pneumonia was simply unheard of in previously healthy people. Pneumocystis had only appeared in people who had compromised immune systems. In this patient, there was something different going on, and it turned out the man had AIDS. Dr. Gottlieb was the first American doctor to make that diagnosis, and it quite literally changed the world. Dr. Gottlieb graduated from the University of Rochester School of Medicine and Dentistry, and today he is back in Rochester giving a presentation titled HIV/AIDS From Beginning to End. But when will the end come? Well, in 2001, Dr. Gottlieb predicted we could see a vaccine by the year 2010. And then in 2011, in a conversation with the Washington Post, he recalled those comments and said he's getting out of the business of predictions. So we won't ask for any predictions this hour, but we do want to talk about where we are and where we possibly could be going next year. Let me welcome my guest, and it's an honor to have Dr. Michael Gottlieb here, not only the man behind that first diagnosis of AIDS in this country, but an associate clinical professor of medicine at UCLA. Dr. Gottlieb, nice to have you.
Thank you, Evan. Great to be here.
Also here is Dr. Steve Dewhurst, who's the Vice Dean for Research at URMC and the Director of the Center for AIDS Research at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Steve, nice to see you.
Nice to see you also, Evan.
And Dr. Michael Kiefer, head of the HIV Vaccine Trials Unit at the University of Rochester Medical Center. And Dr. Kiefer, nice to have you back as well.
Thanks, Evan.
Did I get the story mostly right there, Dr. Gottlieb? That was that fascinating and remarkable moment of a discovery that obviously you didn't wake up that day expecting to find a patient like that.
You got it quite right, Evan. It was shocking to see a patient with pneumocystis pneumonia come into hospital. I remember at the University of Rochester Medical School considering the diagnosis once in my years there, and in fact, the patient we considered it in didn't have it. And so this patient with pneumocystis, previously healthy, coming in with that diagnosis was really something shocking.
Because typically you would see it in immunocompromised people, people with going through cancer treatment, chemotherapy, that kind of thing?
Absolutely. And then it became commonplace after AIDS.
So at that day, I mean, I don't know how quickly it did move after that, but what was your process? Do you meet with your colleagues? Do you say, look, we're looking at something that is unusual, perhaps dangerous? Were you concerned about, I know people have asked you if you were concerned about your own safety because you don't know how transmission happens. Can you walk us through a little bit of that?
So early on, of course, we didn't know it was a virus at the time, that the virus was the cause of the immune deficiency. And so we saw this first patient with immune deficiency and pneumocystis, tested his cells in the laboratory and found that this critical blood cell called the CD4 cell, the helper cell that's sometimes called the conductor of the immunologic orchestra, that cell was in fact missing in this patient. And then shortly after that, we were referred another several patients, all very similar, young men with fevers and weight loss, and they in fact had pneumocystis as well. And so we collected the series and talked to our colleagues in the medical community locally and determined that in fact this was something new and scary.
And of course, the story's been told in many different places. I recalled watching in 1994 the film version on HBO and the band played on, which of course Dr. Gottlieb was in sort of fictionally but non-fictionally characterized. What did you think of the work that you saw there?
Well, in fact, I hadn't seen it. I haven't seen it.
But you haven't seen it?
I haven't seen the movie, but I did read the
book.
I read the book. And Randy Schultz, who wrote the book, was a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, and he had the AIDS beat. And he really did everyone a great service by memorializing what happened in those early years when it was so difficult to get attention to the new disease.
And we were just talking before the program began about how things have changed. And that's a big part of this conversation this hour, because it was, 2 days ago that Charlie Sheen was on the Today Show with Matt Lauer, and Charlie Sheen, the actor, confirming that he has HIV. In fact, he's had it for about 4 years. I want to listen to some of what he told Matt Lauer about his own diagnosis.
It started with what I thought based on this series of cluster headaches and insane migraines and sweating the bed completely drenched 2-3 nights in a row that I was emergency hospitalized. I thought I had brain tumor. I thought it was over. after a battery of tests and spinal taps, all that crap, they walked in the room and said, boom, here's what's going on. It's a hard 3 letters to absorb, you know? It's a turning point in one's life.
The 3 letters, of course, being HIV. He says that was about 4 years ago, and, Charlie Sheen, like I think many others with HIV now, we realize it's sort of not a death sentence. And Dr. Kiefer, what did you make of what you heard, first of all, from Charlie Sheen on that program and the way he talked about his own symptoms?
Yeah. Well, it sounded like he probably hadn't been tested recently because he's having symptoms associated. And so, it really sounds like he's probably had the infection for a while at that point. We still, all the patients that find out the news, still, it's not an easy thing to deal with in spite of the great advances in treatment. And I guess the fact that it was news, but it wasn't the same as Magic Johnson or even Rock Hudson before, shows that we've made some progress. Now, he, was paying, a blackmailer for a few years. That's kind of surprising that he had to do that, but that speaks to the stigma that still exists around the illness.
Yeah, I actually thought that was, of all the bizarre things around Charlie Sheen, and there are many, I thought perhaps the most bizarre was that he felt that he had to pay millions of dollars to blackmailers not to reveal this when, maybe I'm naive, but I kind of thought, well, it's 2015 or 2011, whenever the diagnosis was made, and you can live that life doesn't stop at that point. That's where I thought it would have changed. You agree?
It should have, but the stigma is a very powerful thing, and we're still faced with that. Just getting people tested and into care. A lot of people just don't want to be tested, don't want to know, and that sort of thing. And it's there are so many medicines that are easy to take nowadays. It doesn't make logical sense. However, emotions don't always follow logic and that sort of thing. So there remains a large amount of stigma out there that our patients face really every day. And some people are able to overcome it, but a lot of people aren't. And I wish we'd be farther along after all these years, but we are where we are.
Well, I do want to contrast the Sheen, the Magic Johnson, the Rock Hudson. And the one thing that I do think stands out in the Charlie Sheen case is he might have felt like there was a stigma. He might have felt like he had to pay blackmailers millions of dollars. But the reaction this week has been sort of muted for a number of reasons. There's a lot going on in the news otherwise. He's not the most sympathetic character. But I do think at least the American public has come to a point where we hear, oh, he doesn't have AIDS. He has HIV. Right. And he's going to be with us for a long time. And that is not how the reaction was decades ago, for obvious reasons.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, true. Looking at it globally, though, we in the U.S. or in developed countries, that is the fact. Still, the vast majority of people in the world don't have full access to these medicines and are in the boat like many of us were, 2 decades ago.
I think importantly said. And so the Rock Hudson case, you go back, I think it was 30 years ago, 1985, and Rock Hudson, of course, was an actor. And Dr. Gottlieb, very different. Charlie Sheen in 2015 and Rock Hudson in 1985, hugely different public reactions, hugely different impact, because at the time, you have said, in those early days of AIDS and HIV, there was public resistance to sort of, I don't know if we mean caring or sort of accepting that this was a problem, and resistance from the Reagan administration, yes?
Well, I think there was a lot of resistance all around. I mean, a new disease, a new syndrome on the scene was not welcome. In the 80s, particularly, there was a very slow response, as you've mentioned, from the Reagan administration. It's those people who have it, and we shouldn't address it because of who has it. And also, Rock Hudson helped a lot. It was kind of a tipping point, if you will, kind of a sea change in people's awareness of what was going on. Several thousand people had diagnosed with AIDS prior to Rock Hudson, but it's kind of below the national consciousness radar. And after Rock Hudson, people kind of became aware that here was this new thing, he was a sympathetic character, and things started happening in terms of federal government response.
Were you disappointed in the early days with the Reagan administration?
I was. It was really very difficult to be out there kind of on your own with these desperately ill patients with so little knowledge about what was going on and with so little money to do the research. And that's why things have come a long way since.
But to make sure we clear up any misunderstandings, you know, some have compared Charlie Sheen, well, Magic Johnson. Well, Magic Johnson's been living with HIV, but you have been asked in some of those online conversations, hey, I heard Magic Johnson is cured. Difference between cured and living with HIV. And our understanding is he's still taking daily drugs to suppress, right?
Well, that's my understanding as well. You know, I think his situation where people heard his announcement in 1991 and were so upset because he was much beloved and they were worried that he was going to die quickly. Well, the fact that he's still with us some 20 years later, I think is a testament to the powerful effect that treatment can have and the importance of patients today to know that, and that they can get tested. If they don't know their HIV status, they can find it out and they can get linked to care and treated.
We're talking to a panel of guests about AIDS, where it has been and where it is going. And if you want to call the program with comments or questions, we'd love to hear from you. It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're right here in Rochester, 263-9994. Dr. Michael Gottlieb is here, who was the first American doctor to make that diagnosis at UCLA back in 1981. And also here, Dr. Michael Kiefer and Dr. Steve Dewhurst there at the University of Rochester Medical Center, working on various forms of AIDS research. And Steve, we're all impatient about where this has been. I think we've had to be patient with this. But I want to talk to the entire panel, and I'll start with you. When the public asks questions, we've been asked this morning, what's more likely? We try not to predict, but what feels more in reach to the medical community, a vaccine or a cure for someone who already has a diagnosis?
I'm not going to answer your question directly, so I won't get into the prediction business.
Okay.
But what I can say is that
it's a fair. It's. I mean, it's no, a fair, it's, you understand
it's,
it.
No, it's fair an question. Understandable and a fair question. But if you want to maybe split hairs a little bit. Vaccine is really about prevention, and I think so your question goes to cure for people who are already infected
yes.
versus prevention in those who are at risk. And in prevention, we have a number of strategies that really do work. So one that we've talked about off-air was pre-exposure prophylaxis, for example. Very effective increasing uptake of that.
PrEP is our community.
PrEP, yep. Yes, exactly. Microbicides, there's also a lot of work in that area. We have microbicides that work. We have outreach and social behavioral interventions that work. So there's a number of interventions we already have that do work in terms of prevention. And obviously the big missing piece, as you alluded to, is a vaccine. I think the exciting thing about a vaccine is something, for example, that Mike was talking about earlier today, and that's the launch of a new vaccine study that he's leading at the University of Rochester with Laron Nelson, a member of a faculty in the School of Nursing. And that study is really going to look at the ability of an antibody to prevent infection. And the notion here is that if the antibody works, that's proof of concept that making a vaccine that produces those kinds of antibodies would be an effective strategy. So that's a huge potential step forward that really is within reach. So in that sense, I think we can be optimistic about developing a vaccine. And I think we have some sense of perhaps what the path would be. In terms of a cure, there's a great deal of interest, and I would say that the difference there perhaps is that we have much less certainty from a clinical standpoint about what might work. The path to a cure is a more complicated path right now and one that we're really very actively researching and exploring, but I think the guidebook, if you want, to what might be effective is muddier right now.
Dr. Kiefer, you want to tell us a little bit more about the study then, and particularly what
sure.
you want the public to know about what's coming up here?
Sure. We've been in the business of testing experimental vaccines for 20 plus years. And during the time that we were testing the best vaccines available, work was going on in the basic labs, which is, you know, what happens with this to better understand how HIV is transmitted and how you might make an antibody or get an antibody to cover all the strains, the diverse strains around the world. And about, you know, between 5 and 10 years ago, an observation was made in some of the basic science labs that some patients, about 20% of them, develop these antibodies that kill all kinds of strains, you know, the diverse strains from around the world. And they do that by neutralizing the virus upon encounter. It doesn't allow the infection to take hold. And with all other antiviral vaccines, that's kind of the mechanism that you know, it makes the vaccine work. So while we've tried various empiric approaches, and actually was rather surprised that the approach with the Thai trial actually showed some effectiveness. That didn't have these broadly neutralizing antibodies, but it did have some antibodies, and there was modest effect. That kind of showed us that, yes, indeed, it's possible to do this. But the excitement about these broadly neutralizing antibodies has really been immense, and it's really what the basic scientists have been looking for 20 years, the Achilles heel of the virus. So in the past 5 years, this has gone from discovery of this antibody to manufacture, to vialing, to be ready for trials and efficacy trials in people. That's pretty fast for the development of a new approach. There's a ton of optimism that this is really the key that we've been looking for all these 20, 25 years. Now, we don't know that for sure. Of course, we got to do the study, but we're really very excited about it. The thing is the antibody we're giving is an infusion. It's pre-made antibody, and that exists in other diseases, respiratory syncytial virus, rabies. You sometimes get that along with an active vaccination, but this will then become an engineering problem. If this antibody works the way we expect it to, then all resources are put into working out the engineering problem of making a vaccine like this. So we're narrowing in on the Achilles heel, I guess, and a ton of optimism here. But of course, we've been wrong before. I guess we get optimistic in this field fairly easily because I've been doing this for 25 years, and to stay sane, you've got to look at the small advances and have high hopes for what we're going to learn from each study.
Well, I want to ask Dr. Gottlieb what he thinks about this kind of research, but let me just follow up with you and ask, explain to our listeners what has made HIV/AIDS in particular so difficult in creating an effective vaccine. What makes it such a challenge?
Well, a couple of things. One, it attacks that very cell that's in charge of the immune system, so the conductor of the immune system orchestra, the T4 or CD4 cell. That's the actual cell that it infects, but that's the cell that we're also trying to arm, and actually when you activate those cells, that it makes it even more susceptible to infection. So that's part of it. And then the other part is really this huge diversity among the strains, the mutations. You know how influenza vaccine, we need a new vaccine every year based upon some of the minor changes in the proteins on the surface of the influenza virus. The variability really dwarfs influenza. And if we took the same approach, well, we just couldn't possibly take the same approach with influenza and make a vaccine every year with 900 different strains or some sort of thing like that. So it's always been a real challenge. For a long time, it wasn't even thought to be necessarily possible. So the results of the trial in Thailand that came out now, about 8 years ago, actually proved that, this is possible.
Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I was going to say, if I could jump in a little bit. Yeah. Also, two other pieces that make it very difficult. One is that it has a so-called glycan shield. It means it's basically covered with sugar molecules. So most of the key protein of the virus is inaccessible to the immune system. And then the second piece that's really critical is that most of its most vulnerable sites are hidden. It sequesters the most invariable domains. So Mike talked about variability, but there are parts of the protein on the surface of the virus that are less variable, but those are sequestered. And the only time they're visible, so to speak, is during this very transient period when the virus is actually infecting an immune cell. So only transiently can you actually get at the business end of the virus if you want. And maybe the other thing I would add is a lot of the research that's been done on HIV has actually given us insights into other viruses or other pathogens. So for example, designing a vaccine for pandemic influenza turns out to have learned a lot from the HIV vaccine story. And similarly, making a vaccine for RSV, Mike talked about a passive antibody, but basically that engineering problem is being very actively addressed for RSV. And it speaks to this path of developing an HIV vaccine. If you can do this for RSV, presumably we'd be able to do it for HIV also.
Dr. Gottlieb, what do you make of what you're hearing then in this kind of research?
Well, I think it's a very exciting line of research. U of R has an incredible history in vaccine development, and it's no surprise that the U of R was awarded a study site for Dr. Kiefer's vaccine trial. It really is an exciting way to get at what determinants, what structures on a virus are important for inclusion in a vaccine. And as Steve mentioned, it has spin off to other areas, other viruses. But to get back briefly to the question of vaccine versus cure, clearly from the standpoint of what's essential for world health, a vaccine is critical. From the standpoint of cure, I clearly understand why the patients want it and why we should pursue it, because it's exciting and possible. On the other hand, patients are doing very well on medication, have a prognosis for normal to near normal lifespan, and the vaccine, we're wanting a vaccine for intervention globally, where people are still becoming infected at a very high rate.
Gary writes to us and says, Evan, I'm clearly not a doctor, but I'm curious to know, do we know the origin of AIDS, and does that help with the creation of a vaccine? The origin of AIDS, I go back, is it incorrect? It's gorillas? African? No?
No,
yes?
that's right.
That is still correct.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and the theory is there's been multiple animal-to-human transmission events that have resulted in the evolution of different lineages of HIV, and that goes a little to Mike's comment about variability. Mm-hmm. So there were these multiple historic transmission events that resulted in the evolution of viruses that became HIV. And so this goes back certainly much more than 50 years as far as the origins of HIV. It certainly tells us a good deal about the molecular biology and the behavior of the virus, though. And it also tells us the virus can exist safely in combination with certain animal hosts. So there are some animal species that don't develop an AIDS-like illness when infected with a virus that is like HIV. So it tells us something positive in that regard. But it still remains a challenge, I would say, in terms of developing a vaccine.
If I could add, I believe HIV-2 came from gorillas, HIV-1 from chimpanzees, I think.
But well, if I could jump in, I think HIV-1 came from chimpanzees, and that's the common AIDS virus worldwide. I think HIV-2 came from the sooty mangabey, which is a small monkey in West Africa.
Okay, and initial contact with humans was killing and eating? Is that what we assume? Is that still correct?
That has commonly been the assumption, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Not so much contracting it through eating it, but slaughtering an animal and cutting oneself in the process and mixing blood.
And so, Dr. Gottlieb, even though your work and sort of discovery here happened in 1981 at UCLA, when our medical world had no idea, that certainly wasn't the first case here, and it certainly wasn't the first year it was here. Do we have an idea for when AIDS really did arrive in this country? Do we think it was 60s, 70s?
Well, pretty clearly from Red Cross studies looking back on frozen blood specimens from the 70s, I think the first positive specimen appears in 1977. And then looking back further on frozen specimens from Congo, one tests positive from 1959. And so, but when it came to the U.S., clearly it was here in 77. There's been some speculation, or actually some data, based on using evolution of the virus as a biological clock, that the virus may have been here in the 60s.
So you're back in Rochester. Hmm. You were in school in Rochester, Dr. Gottlieb. When?
I was here, graduated in 73 and residency in 77.
Okay. And you're going to be, you're presenting. Well, tell us a little bit about what brought you back here this week.
Well, tonight, in anticipation of World AIDS Day, which is December 1st, where the world kind of focuses on the HIV epidemic, in anticipation of that, we're doing a program tonight from the beginning to the present time in which I talk a little bit about the early days that I experienced, and then we transition to the very exciting research that's being done here at the University of Rochester.
And a listener named Rick goes back to those early days. He says, Evan, please send my thanks to Dr. Gottlieb for his work in this field. I'm also interested to know if there's any regret on the name that HIV got first, GRID, gay-related immune deficiency. Did that contribute to the stigma of gay people?
Well, I think it might have contributed for a short time, but it was abandoned very quickly. And the CDC, in their wisdom, named it AIDS in the spring of 1982.
So as much as you were seeing it in the gay population, it was pretty apparent early on, even if it was prevalent in that population, that it wasn't just a gay disease, right?
Yeah, but that label stuck on for a long time, and it persists to this day and probably contributes to some extent to the ongoing stigma associated with HIV.
Dr. Kiefer, you're nodding. You agree with that?
Yep.
Yeah.
No additional comments, I don't think. Right.
Well, we've been talking about that history with Dr. Michael Gottlieb, who is in town today. He's an associate clinical professor of medicine at UCLA, and his work 34 years ago helped open the door for diagnosis and certainly decades now of an attempt at treatment and even the possible down-the-road creation of vaccines. So Dr. Michael Kiefer and Dr. Steve Dewhurst here, they are in research in various ways. Dr. Kiefer, the head of the HIV Vaccine Trials Unit at URMC, and Steve's the vice dean for research at URMC and the director of the Center for AIDS Research at the University of Rochester Medical Center. More of your questions, and on the question of a cure, we'll talk in just a minute when we come back from this short break about what we have seen and what's realistic when it comes to not a vaccine, but a cure now. That's next. Coming up in our second hour, our panel from the local Islamic community reacts to Paris. They share with us how they have experienced the attacks and the aftermath. From threats to prejudice to the goal of unifying here in Rochester and around the world against ISIS. Our conversation and your questions answered next hour.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the estate of Violet Smithers, supporting WXXI Public Broadcasting and its work to educate and inspire.
All right, welcome back to Connections. And Steve was just saying during our short break here, just making sure we sort of pin down what we do know about the origin of AIDS, where it came from. And we kind of said gorillas for HIV-1, and then what was the name of the
chimpanzees.
Chimpanzees.
So, just to clarify, because we were just wanting to clarify this. So there are multiple different subgroups of HIV, and so some of those subgroups, the most common one, comes from chimpanzees. But there are others that come from, as you were saying, Evan, gorillas. And then there's this second HIV virus, HIV-2, that's particularly common in West Africa. And that virus comes from sooty mangabeys, as Dr. Gottlieb was saying. So there are actually multiple transmission events involving multiple either apes or monkeys evolving in humans to become HIV.
And Dr. Gottlieb?
And so I think what Steve has just said sort of illustrates the fact that HIV is what we call a zoonosis, which is an animal virus that jumped species. And we've had multiple examples of that in recent years with SARS and Middle East respiratory syndrome, and it's just an example of the situation where people living in close proximity with their animals stand some risk. And of course, this isn't dogs and cats. I want to make that clear. But people living in close proximity with their livestock, or in the case of HIV, slaughtering animals for meat, primates, that is. There is the risk of transmission across species, with a more severe disease in the recipient species than in the donor.
It also gets at the impact of environmental change, so that, you know, if you consider, for example, the effects of global warming, one of the rather more predictable effects will be that mosquitoes that carry human viral diseases like dengue fever, for example, are likely to migrate up into parts of Texas, for example, in this country, and that will change the epidemiology of that disease. And in that sense, there are other zoonotic infections that one can point to that are clearly related to environmental impact, or in the case of HIV, it's urbanization and global travel, truck routes in Africa and so on, that have played a surprisingly large effect in the evolution of the HIV pandemic.
I was just going to add another good example. The zoonosis that we talk about a lot, maybe not every day, is pandemic flu, you know, bird flu, swine flu, that sort of thing. Much more serious in people when it comes from the other animal source.
Well, Jake wants to go deep in our search for answers. A listener named Jake writes, this is an indirectly related question, but with HIV, Ebola, and many other nasty diseases coming out of Africa, is there any link between that supposition and Africa being the presumed origin of human life?
I'll take a stab at that and say I don't really think so. I think we talked about these examples, Ebola being obviously one that's very much sort of captured the public imagination because of its lethality. But if you were to take a less exotic virus, hantavirus, for example, emerged in the four corners of the United States totally because of environmental change, and it resulted in a certain species of mouse finding its way into human homes and transmitting a virus that's normally present in mice to humans. So there's plenty of cases of zoonoses that occur, I think, outside of Africa. Certainly, HIV and Ebola probably did both emerge in Africa, but I wouldn't make the assumption that zoonosis is in any way a unique phenomenon to Africa.
Now, our panelists just talked about the possible impact of climate change on the future of epidemiology, and I hadn't thought about that relationship, but I'm wondering if are there segments of the medical community that are trying to get ahead of that to assume where, you mentioned where dengue might mm-hmm. go as just one example, and I'm sure there are more.
Yeah.
This has been a theme of the hour, no one can really accurately predict exactly where anything's going, but how much can we get out ahead and make assumptions on what climate change might do to the future of disease?
Well, I think a fair bit. So you can look at, for example, global temperature, which is going to be a major influence on, for example, mosquitoes and where they go, or it's the influence of water temperature if you're thinking about cholera as a waterborne disease. And so if you have a sense of what those changes might be, then you can try to get ahead of if it's an insect-borne disease with insect control measures, if it's a vaccine-preventable disease with vaccine prevention, if it's a waterborne disease with higher quality water protection, if you want to ensure that the water we drink is really drinkable. Less of a problem in the U.S., but certainly much more of a problem for less developed countries.
Okay. Well, that's a part of the discussion I didn't anticipate, but just another example of how there's all these unintended consequences, even of something like climate change. Now, I want to talk about a possible cure. I had read briefly, and not with any depth at all, about a case, again, I thought out of Germany, was that correct, gentlemen? Out of Germany, that someone had spent a lot of money and gone through quite a lot on the medical side to cure HIV or AIDS? Was it
HIV? So the notion here is, as we were talking off air, the patient in particular is a man called Timothy Ray Brown, who stepped forward to identify himself. And he's really, his experience and what happened with him really has changed the way we think about HIV. I think previous to him, we thought of HIV as being essentially incurable. One would take antiviral drugs for life. And he, as far as everybody knows, has been cured of HIV. His path to a cure is a path that nobody would voluntarily want to undergo, at least his unique personal story. He developed a cancer that had to be treated by bone marrow transplants, plural, and he had to go through a whole series of therapies as a consequence of that. Plus, he had a very imaginative and creative medical provider who ensured that the bone marrow transplants he got were from an individual who was resistant to HIV. So he chose a bone marrow transplant that was missing a particular gene that makes one susceptible to HIV. So it was a constellation of things that resulted in him becoming cured. And the question really on the table is, can we reproduce those circumstances in a more controlled way and in a safer way, and do that in a way then that would allow us to cure HIV infection in a much, much larger group of people?
What do we know about the answers to some of that?
So there are a number of potential strategies of which one is often referred to as shock and kill. And so the notion of shock and kill is that you shock the virus into reemerging. So that one of the complexities of HIV and the real conundrum in cure is the virus becomes latent, so it just sort of infects a cell type and there's no way to know the virus is there. So it becomes latent in extremely long-lived memory T cells. And if you think about our immune memory, it has to survive as long as we do. the infection that we had with influenza when we were a child is the infection that is remembered by those memory T cells the rest of our lives. So that poses a real challenge. How do you eradicate these cells that don't show any sign of being infected and that live decades? And so the trick of the shock part is then that we develop drugs that reactivate the virus. So now the virus is expressed, and then the kill part is fairly obvious, that you engender some way of eliminating those cells. So the notion would be that you want to shock all of the latently infected cells to express virus and then ensure that they're killed in some manner, either immunologically or otherwise.
Alan writes to the program and says he has, let me pull it up here, experience with Truvada. How do we pronounce it?
Truvada.
Truvada. And wants to know if there's a better version coming.
I take it, if since he's saying Truvada alone, that would be in PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis, because Truvada is taken by patients with HIV, but there's always an additional drug on board. There's even a new form of Truvada that's pretty near to coming out, but there's actually a lot of other forms of PrEP that are being looked at, longer acting. We do know that PrEP works pretty well if you take it. The problem is at least the current state of PrEP is you take it every day. And if you don't, you know, it doesn't work. Injectable antivirals that might last 2 or 3 months, that sort of thing, are other things that are being looked at now. So Truvada is, you know, kind of the standard of prevention now. Wouldn't at all be surprised if there's modifications to that over the next even few years, within the next 5 years.
We have a listener just wants to know just how often they should be HIV testing, and essentially an email, rather lengthy email from a listener who wanted to know about being in a relationship with someone with HIV and how much the safety of that kind of relationship has changed over the years. I believe, Dr. Gottlieb, you have talked at various times about even couples who wanted to conceive a child, and you know how I'm sure that was a non-starter 30 years ago, but that idea has changed, I think.
Well, I think we've certainly seen instances where people who are HIV positive have been able to be fathers, men who are HIV positive, and that's been as a result of in vitro fertilization. So that's been the norm until recently. And the question, of course, is whether Truvada, taken by an HIV-negative woman, would be adequate protection for inducing a pregnancy the normal way with an HIV-positive man who is, in fact, undetectable. And that is one potential strategy for childbearing by an HIV-positive individual.
Now, what do you advise people who are asking about how often they should be tested if they're in a sexually active relationship, particularly with a partner, you know, with HIV, et cetera?
I can address the New York State guidelines. Actually, part of this in the epidemic by 2020 New York State plan has eased up on the requirements for getting HIV testing. It used to be the medical community kind of avoided doing it because there's so many steps in the process and all that. Everyone now should be tested, everyone between, 16 and 65 or something like that, tested at least once. They recommend then annual testing for people who have risk behaviors, and then even more frequently for people that are considered at very high risk, although in those people you'd probably go on to a PrEP sort of thing. One thing we didn't point out exactly, but that Michael did mention, another huge advance has been the understanding that if you treat people effectively, you know, HIV-infected patients effectively, and their virus is very beaten down, very quiescent, undetectable, we call it, their risk of transmission is very low. So that in itself is probably one of the most effective ways to cut transmission.
Non-zero.
But, getting pregnant sort of situation, you definitely want the patient, whoever the patient is, to be undetectable, and then probably have the other person on PrEP. And okay. I guess the other person will have to be a female, right?
The current state of technology.
Okay, right, but in other words, you're not counseling people, or the medical advice is not that you can't conceive, you can't have children, you can't be sexually active. And 30 years ago, Dr. Gottlieb, what would it have been?
Well, 30 years ago, we still didn't know enough to make sound recommendations.
But 25, 20 years ago,
we were still recommending in vitro fertilization, mm-hmm. and several instances of that happened, and there are lots of kids around who were in fact conceived by HIV-positive fathers that way. But in terms of prevention, I think our message is pretty much the same. I don't think we know enough to discard condoms altogether, and that's still very much part of our message, even for people on PrEP.
Dr. Michael Gottlieb is here in Rochester for the day as a guest of URMC, where he was a student just over 40 years ago. And Dr. Gottlieb is a name that you might know because he was part of a team, one of the first American doctors to really make a diagnosis of HIV/AIDS back in 1981. It was at UCLA. We told that story earlier this hour, but if I could, I just want to talk a little bit more then about what did happen in those following years and what we've learned about it, because, you know, there's no game plan when you discover something new like that, Dr. Gottlieb. But, you know, you go back and change things, whether it is, we've talked about the government and sort of public reaction, the medical community. What do you look back and wish had gone differently?
Well, I sort of wish it hadn't taken a major celebrity developing AIDS to have us, put the full court press on HIV/AIDS research. But in fact, that often happens in our society with other disease states as well. You know, it takes a celebrity to raise awareness. So I'm sort of glad that happened and that it had some impact. But I think the industry has been a very important partner in this as well, with AZT being the first medication introduced in 1987. And providing proof of principle, I think, to the pharmaceutical industry that they could, in fact, sell an effective HIV medication, and caused other companies to come into the field and develop many of the agents we have today that are FDA approved for HIV that have changed the prognosis. I think we also have to pay homage to the activists who helped us get a response from the federal government and some spending on important AIDS research and centers like those that exist here at the U of R, which have been instrumental in moving forward progress on treatment and now vaccine. So we thank the activists for some of their early activity, primarily in the gay community, mm-hmm. People in New York who put their bodies in the street to get a response and get the attention of Congress and the federal bureaucracy.
Absolutely, and some of those rather dramatic moments, at least the way that they are described, and as we've talked about, the book and then the film and the band played on, which attempted to capture those moments. Sometimes there's a little dramatic license when they create a film, etc., but some of those moments captured in the film, and I assume in the book as well, were very emotional. People representing the gay community feeling like, how many people need to die before this is taken seriously? When are we going to increase funding? What is it about the medical community that what would it take to not, you know, sort of cast this as just a gay problem? Were those kinds of emotional discussions, was that pretty true to life, what we saw?
I think so, definitely. And also, if you look at the movie Dallas Buyers Club, mm-hmm. and the movie How to Survive a Plague. Remarkably, movies are so important in generating public reaction and emotional reaction. And those movies are very, very moving, and more than moving pictures, but they're very emotionally moving to have people understand what it was like during the period of Dallas Buyers Club, 1989 through 1990, when only one medication was on the market and people were looking outside the country to import anything that might help.
The last time Steve was on this program, we talked about funding and the state of research that, if you want to remind our listeners, you find pretty grim right now, Steve?
Yes, I do, yes. The federal funding for research, as we talked about before, has in real dollar terms declined very substantially over the last decade, and it's really a concern to all of us in the research community.
And so part of that conversation focused on the impact going forward when it's difficult to get a grant to begin with. And I'm curious to know how AIDS research is impacted in that way, if at all. Steve?
Well, actually, it's a very timely question, Evan. So the NIH is presently reevaluating its priorities for AIDS research. And some of that is very reasonable in the sense of we're really at a very different place with HIV research than we were previously. So we have, for the most part, drugs that are effective. They do need to be improved. We are very interested in long-lasting antivirals, and that really goes to something that Mike was talking about and allows you to maybe to get to a functional cure. Very interested in vaccines. So what NIH is doing with AIDS research, I think, is really restating its priorities for the epidemic we have today in 2015, which I think is a reasonable and appropriate thing to do.
Dr. Kiefer, you want to weigh in on the state of research funding?
So most of my support comes from the NIH, so yeah. I'm a little biased here. But even talking about cancer research and all forms of health research, I think it was Newt Gingrich, who I don't agree on a lot he says, but he wanted to double the NIH budget. And I've read some things about how much, you know, funding, you know, return on investment. It really sounds to me, and particularly we're all interested in being healthy, you know, staying healthy. It seems like a good investment to me. And to cut that, no doubt there's government waste all over the place, but it just seems like we'd more likely want to double it rather than cut it.
Maybe just to amplify that, what the point Mike was just making, and it goes back to something Dr. Gottlieb said, which is that many of those antiviral drugs that we have, in fact, have their origins in academic research that was funded by the NIH. And that's a very important point. While we need industry as a partner to develop them into a commercial product, discovery is something NIH funds. And without NIH funding, we won't have discovery.
And I would add to what Steve says that it's the people who trained at the great research universities of this country, like the U of R, people who studied in the laboratories of Dr. Dewhurst and others, who are working with some of these agents and who may go on to the industry and continue working there, but they acquire their skills and background at NIH-funded projects at research universities.
Dr. Gottlieb, have you thought over the years about what would have happened had you not had that sort of confluence of events to find that patient in 1981 who was immunosuppressed, 31 years old? I assume he passed away shortly after you met him. Is that correct?
He passed away about 9 months later.
Okay.
Yeah. But I think I understand your question, Evan. And basically, AIDS was such a dramatic illness and pneumocystis such a dramatic development that someone else would have,
certainly,
very quickly.
And you think soon after that, if it hadn't been you at that moment, it would have been somebody else relatively soon thereafter.
Probably within weeks. And of course, my life would be very different today. I would still be in the lab doing transplantation research. It would be much quieter, and I wouldn't be on radio shows like yours, which I've enjoyed.
Well, I appreciate you being here. The last comment of the hour comes from Pablo, a listener who says, Evan, if I may say, I could give a damn about Charlie Sheen, but the reason that people aren't reacting to his diagnosis is that HIV has been relatively normalized. Our generation does not view this as that big a deal. Don't get me wrong, HIV is a serious problem, but we don't assume someone is going to die. The biggest question is, how is someone with HIV going to be treated by those around them? Pablo, it's a great question, and it's a great way to finish the hour, because someone with HIV now can, you know, with the right kind of treatment and hopefully with the resources, and our panel is distinguished, if you're living in the United States or if you're living in sort of a place of privilege, it's different than getting a diagnosis in different parts of the world. But if you get treatment and diagnosis pretty early on, you can expect to live a long time. And then the question becomes, are the employers going to treat them fairly? Are the people around them? And I think that's a very fair question. Panel agree?
Totally agree. And it goes very much to the point Mike made earlier about, you know, Charlie Sheen's own reticence to come forward with his diagnosis. It speaks to this issue of stigma.
Even with someone like Charlie Sheen, who you would think money is not an issue, but what if you're not a Hollywood superstar and you've got this diagnosis, you want to keep working. Is there a concern about stigma at work and employers and the way people will treat you? I would assume.
I would assume so too.
Yeah, the laws in New York State are pretty good with discrimination, but you can't really legislate stigma per se. I mean, you know, there's a difference there. One's a legal thing, and the other is just sort of a personal thing. And it's going to, you know, it sounds like Pablo's of the younger generation, which is great. I think that's what it's going to take, is replace some of us old people with young people with better ideas.
Dr. Gottlieb, it's been a great pleasure hearing you tell your story and the work that you've done that goes back decades now. And here's hoping, without predicting, that we are headed for a vaccine and a cure at some point. Thanks for the work that you've done, and thanks for being here today.
Thanks so much, Evan.
Dr. Michael Gottlieb joining us this hour. And Steve Dewhurst, Michael Kiefer from the University of Rochester Medical Center continue to do great work. Thank you both very much for being here.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
All right, short break, and we're talking to the local Islamic community next about their experiences since Paris. Stay with us.